Blog Talk Radio.
And hello and welcome to the Falcon Zone. I am your host, Jeremy York, joined by Coach Haywood and, of course, Reggie Walker. How you doing this week, Reggie?
Hey, I'm doing good, Jeremy. Hey, Coach, how you doing? Hello?
I'm good. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm doing good. I thought you had me muted there.
No, we didn't have you muted. Of course not. But we will be joined by our special guest, Harper LaBelle, here in a few short minutes. First, as we mentioned on End Zone a few minutes ago, we're saddened by the passing of Tampa Bay owner Malcolm Glazer. He did so many great things for Tampa Bay. And even though we are Falcons fans and representing the great city of Atlanta and state of Georgia, we're going to really miss this guy in the league because he did a lot of things to help make the NFC South just as good as it was.
Definitely heartfelt condolences goes out to the Glazer family. I mean, he was a great guy. He obviously made a great pick, I think, in a head coach before, so hopefully he'll get to see those guys thrive under a guy that he picked from up above. So definitely condolences out to the Tampa Bay Bucks.
Yeah, definitely so. And, you know, he was able to bring a championship to Tampa, which is just one more for the NFC South. Currently, is, you know, the Falcons haven't been able to raise that Lombardi trophy yet, but I feel like it could be coming in the next few years. And one person that could be helping raise that trophy is safety Dwight Lowry, who was named the secret superstar for the Falcons by Pro Football Focus. They said that he adds an underrated pass coverage to the already great defensive back core. Now, a little bit about Mr. Lowry. He was drafted by the New York Jets in the fourth round of the 2008 NFL draft out of San Jose State. He was a beast in college. He was a very good defensive back. It was very hard to beat him. After being with the Jets for a little while, he was able to play a couple years in Jacksonville. I was able to see him play last year. He is phenomenal in the field. He's like having a center fielder wherever you want to put him. And, of course, then the Falcons were able to pick him up earlier this year. What do you like about Dwight Lowry there, Reggie?
I mean, obviously he brings that dynamic that you're looking for from the cornerback position, which I know Coach Hill knows that slot very well. He definitely is going to be an impact player. I see him as one of those high-risk, high-reward type of players, especially considering, you know, he's had a few injuries, most particularly that concussion that he had last year that kept him out, I think, three-quarters of the season. But that being said, you got a guy who's now obviously fully recovered. They brought him in. Now I think he even can play a little bit of safety. So that Thomas Dekou void that was left when we released him got a little bit smaller when you brought this guy in. So I'm excited to see what he does. I think that allows them to shift Alford maybe over to some nickelback sometimes and maybe pull him into a safety spot because now you got another true cover corner that you can have on that outside.
Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, to me, they're building such a crazy secondary of just talent on top of talent on top of talent. And, you know, clearly a lot of these guys are probably not going to stick around for the entire team, but they've added so much depth on this defense that, you know, if I'm Drew Brees, if I'm Cam Newton, if I'm whoever the Buccaneers decide to dress at quarterback this year, I'm pretty scared to look at this defense.
Right, and I think that's what I love the most about it. We're a speedy defense now. Atlanta has crafted and drafted a large defense. So even running against this team is going to be tough. Because you got speed on the outsides now with those linebackers. So even with the pass rush, I think they're addressing the issue. Hey, if we don't necessarily have the pass rush we want, you can throw it if you want to because we definitely got a secondary that can cover these guys.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And also one of the big things that happened this week where they were able to lock down the second-round pick defensive end Rashid Hageman, who signed the four-year, $5.34 million contract with about $3.25 million of that guaranteed. Once again, this is just more of this depth, and I think this is their way of kind of putting a little bit of a fire under Perry Ejiri and maybe even OCU Manura here to, you know, you need to start pulling a little more of your end of the line here. We've already got somebody ready to take your spot.
Right, and with Hageman, I think what we'll find out before the year is out, I think this guy is one of the starters or becomes one of your starters at the tackle spot. He definitely, it's already been noted, we said on earlier shows, he's a first-round talent and actually considered one of the steals of the draft. One thing I do like and love about the Falcons organization, and this is just another example of that, is how well Rich McKay and those guys manage the cap space. I mean, to get a guy, first-round talent, for 5.5 and you're giving him 3, he's really only counting about 2 towards the cap, and that's over a 4-year period. So, again, hats off to the front office for pulling off that financial windfall for Atlanta as well.
Yeah, Reggie, I think that Atlanta did a great job with that. I want to back up into the safety for a minute. I think the reason why Lowry comes aboard is because, you know, again, you're drafting you drafted a safety, and now he needs a mentor. Mm-hmm. And so bringing Lowry over gives him that. As far as the cap space is concerned, they're doing a very good job of getting young players. I don't think I've seen Atlanta actually come with so many young players in a long time. So now it's a lot of competition in camp, and it's a lot of competition for jobs, as we saw two defensive linemen jump over to the offensive side of the ball. So you're starting to see a lot of moving and shifting early in camp as they get prepared for camp. Minicamp has been very competitive. They brought a lot of undrafted free agents in who are starting to make names for themselves. So a lot of this is panning itself out. I think Atlanta has always been that type of premier city where players would want to come and play, but trying to manage that under the cap was a big piece of it. Now that they've been able to find a healthy way to do that, it's going to be incredible to see what Atlanta does with all this talent that they have coming in.
Yeah, and one more thing I want to say, speak on, even with, and you're talking about the safety that we drafted southward. One of the things I find very interesting even about bringing in Lowry, and you got to wonder how much this plays into it, he is the only draft pick that has yet to sign with Atlanta, considering even the fact that he's a fourth rounder. So I think that may, or I'm sorry, a third rounder, that may have played a role in this as well, to say, hey, you know, yeah, we want you on board, but we do have options just in case. So hopefully this guy goes ahead and gets signed so he can start digesting the playbook and getting really involved in the defense.
Absolutely. And, you know, speaking of positions that really need that'll probably see a lot of change this year, we're about to – talk to our very special guest, former Falcon tight end. He was a part of one of my favorite teams, or at least the major team that I remember in my short career as a Falcons fan. But want to bring on Harper LaBelle right now. Harper, how you doing?
Doing great, Jeremy. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you on. You know, we were talking about some of the changes across the Falcons landscape, and we're talking about Dwight Lowry that they picked up. He was drafted by the Jets. The Jaguars got him from there for a couple years, and now the Falcons will be able to pick him up. This just adds more to their pass coverage. As a tight end, What do you look at as far as defensive backs? Do you guys try to pick on them, or is there certain matchups you guys like better?
Well, from a size perspective, most of the safeties, and those are the guys that would cover a tight end, if you've got a few inches and a few pounds, then you like the relationship. There are the guys going to be faster than you, but you know where you're going and he doesn't. He's got a guess. So there is a little bit of a positioning. Tony Gonzalez made a career out of doing that, of being able to say, okay, I'm going to get to this certain spot, and I'm going to go against a guy who's 2-3 inches shorter than I am, and I can just it was incredible at being able to put his body in between the defender and the ball and make a 7-8 yard catch, fall forward for 10 yards, or break a tackle and go for 15 or 20. Those are the things you look at with most DBs. Linebackers are thicker, but most tight ends are a little bit taller, so you've got that type of relationship. When you go to the outside, it's really all speed, and it doesn't matter if you're 6 feet or 5'11 or 6'4". If you can run, and cover the best receiver on the other team, that's a definitive advantage for any defense.
Definitely so. And, you know, since you came out of Colorado State for the 1985 draft, were able to get picked round 12 back when they had 12 rounds back then by Kansas City. But what was the biggest transition between Colorado State and, you know, those first few rookie practices as a Kansas City Chief?
Well, I was out of position. I was drafted because I could long snap as a center. And so I had played tight end exclusively at CSU, so I had to learn how to snap and do everything that a center would. So I was handicapped from the get-go and wasn't in camp for more than 3.5 or 4 weeks. We played in our first preseason game, and they kind of said, this isn't going to work out. But I was out of football for four years before I eventually made it. But the biggest transition for me was going against a guy that was probably 30, 40 pounds bigger. Everybody on the defensive line was heavier than I was. So there was a real size issue that I had to overcome. And unfortunately, I didn't do it. So I'm not a center, but I did get the snap for 10 years because I could do that pretty good.
Yeah, absolutely. You did it quite well. Like I was saying before we brought you on, you were a part of, to me, the more special team, at least the one that I remember cheering for the most as I was growing up around here. You know, you were on the same team as Jamal Anderson and Bob Whitfield and Chuck Smith and a lot of those guys. You guys really had a special team here in Atlanta for at least 5 or 6 good years.
Well, when I first got here in 91, I think the greatest thing for me was the newness, the excitement, and the genuine enthusiasm for both the Falcons and the Braves at the same time. The Braves made it to the World Series, and Dion was on the team. So here you got a guy you're practicing with, and then he's literally leaving a few minutes early, taking a helicopter downtown to go play in a game, and then come back for practice the next day. And, you know, he's the only guy that was on the same day able to play in a playoff game and then and scored a touchdown in a game as well. But very interesting that you would bring that up. You know, Bob and Jamal and Lincoln Kennedy were all draft picks that ended up making the team, and obviously when the Dirty Birds went to the Super Bowl, that was heroic. The first team ever to do that. I was not on the roster for that particular year, but those are great guys and fond memories of all of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, seeing as how you were a very effective tight end, is there somebody on the roster right now, you know, especially with Gonzalez leaving and no longer being a part of the team? You know, we wish him the best in all his new media ventures and, of course, in retirement and getting able to spend time with his kids. You know, who's kind of the next guy up, or do you feel like the tight end position is going to transition to something different for the Falcons?
Well, I think in all of Tony's greatness, the things that he does that made him a Hall of Famer, there are probably some other tight ends on the roster that can block a little bit better than him, and especially for goal line and short yardage positions. You're never going to take him out of the ball game, but no one can fulfill what he was able to do on the receiving end. At least we haven't seen that in the last 17 years, right? He's been the premier guy. There are others that are similar to. You've got Graham in New Orleans, and you've got Gates in San Diego that are basketball type guys. But I would think that originally on the roster, or at least right now, how do you replace him? That's going to be a work in motion, because how do you do it that with anybody? I will say this, though. I bet you, and I'm not going to, you know, put money on it, but I'm just thinking, in some respects, defensive coordinators from just our division alone, let's go in Carolina, stay in New Orleans or Tampa, I think this presents a bigger challenge to them. And the reason I say that is because you always had to double-team Tony, right, in the goal line or the red zone. You knew that Matt was going to try to hit him in one aspect or another. Is it going to be a little hook route over the ball? Are you going to run him on a quick out route or maybe run him up the seam in a post? So you had to double-cover him. Now you won't have to. You're going to double-cover Roddy or Julio if he's healthy. Do you double-cover Harry Douglas? Anyone else? Devin Hester? So it's going to create a different and unique problem for defensive coordinators. But replacing him, I don't know how we're going to do it, but getting somebody in that can manage to get numbers in the 20 or 30 or 40 catches Boy, if we do that, that would be an ace in the hole for me in terms of how the offensive production will increase in spite of him not being there.
Absolutely. Hey, Harper. This is Reggie Walker. I'm actually one of the guys, co-hosts. It was good meeting you up at Dave and Buster's a couple of weeks ago. I got a question specifically for you because one of the issues I've kind of had at the tight end spot is I think that the book has kind of been closed a little bit on Teolo a little bit sooner than maybe we should. I don't think, and I've talked to a lot of fans about this guy and the fact that, you know, he was the first rounder out at Stanford before he got hurt, or I'm sorry, the first stringer out at Stanford before he got hurt. So given the amount of time and the amount of time he spent with Tony, do you think that he could even halfway give, you mentioned that 20-catch season, I think he's a guy that can give us, you know, at least half of that. I mean, what are your thoughts about what you've seen out of that guy so far as a tight end?
Yeah, that's a great question, and part of the reason it's hard to answer is because Tony was there, and you cannot answer a question, well, how would you do? He wasn't there. Teolo wasn't in the lineup. Tony was not going to come out, and so seeing how he does now that he's the man and it's really his job to win or lose, that's going to be a great phenomenon that we'll find out probably starting as early as now with the OTAs and obviously in the preseason. A couple of fade routes, maybe a seam, see if he's got some speed to burst up the middle. He'll never be Tony Gonzalez, and I wouldn't want him to be, but I want him to be the best person he can be and kind of tweak a little bit of what he learned from number 88 and from others that he's played around or watched and kind of tweak his game to make it a little bit better. Reggie, I think that he's going to be very good, but he hasn't had a real chance yet. So before the Falcon fans or anybody can really say he's not panning out, let's get him in the lineup and have him start for 2, 3, 4 series in a row, couple of games, even furthermore. I think he'll do quite well, especially with the ability that Matt Ryan has to find him as the second or third receiver or to go to him first. You know, there'll be a couple different options where he may be one-on-one coverage and beat somebody, and we get a big gain out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I really think that guy's going to be one of our surprise guys this year, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what he can do on the field without the pressure of having to mimic Tony Gonzalez. And unfortunately, I think he's got that bad rap now of having, you know, he's got that pressure on him maybe. So Teolo, if you're listening out there, I mean, just relax and play your game, do you? So I appreciate the answer there.
I would think he will do a fine job when he proves that he deserves it. And just like anybody, you got to earn your spot. You're going to compete in training camp and during the course of the season every day. And Pete Carroll has been phenomenal at making that a part of the way that he coaches. He did it at USC. He's been doing it in Seattle the last couple of years. The dividends are obvious. Have everybody, when you come on Wednesday, bring your A game. And if you do well, we will find a spot for you in the lineup. It's not just Derek Jeter's our shortstop. He's going to be an all-star every year, whether he plays well or not. You got to earn it. And that's the thing I think the Falcons will be doing a lot of this year, as they mend what happened last year and try to get themselves back into the playoff picture and go into the second, third, fourth round.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Sorry, go ahead, Reggie.
No, I was just saying, agreeing with him. Go ahead, Jeremy.
Okay. I was just saying that, you know, yeah, it was really nice to get to interact and chat with you, Mr. LaBelle, especially at the 92.9 The Game, which you do a lot of work for them as well. One of the many things you do to give back to the game. We were able to be part of Media Row at the draft event there and everything. But you also have called all the Georgia State games and have kind of been there since the beginning as that program has started to take off. Can you tell us a little bit more about their transition and where they are right now?
Well, sure. Thank you for bringing it up. I've really enjoyed and kind of keeps me young. There's a certain amount of football that as the years go by, and I'm 50 now, that you could easily say, ah, that doesn't affect me because, you know, it doesn't involve me personally. But I've been able to stay close to the game, and Georgia State started their program in 2010, And here they are going ready in just a few months. In August, they'll be playing Abilene Christian, one of the first games of the season for all of college football, going into their fifth year. And I've been a part of the play-by-play and the color analysis along with Sam Crenshaw and Dave Cohen. And it's been a lot of fun. The program has kind of struggled a little bit, but they've progressed to the point where last year didn't count. It was a transition year. But now they're starting to get better recruits. The facilities are light years ahead of where they were just a couple of years ago. They're budgeting and doing some things right that make it very easy to say that they're not there today, but in a couple of years they may be fighting for a Sun Belt championship. And with the quality of high school sports around the Georgia area, they're really ripe to take advantage of maybe a couple of four stars and a lot of three stars that they're not getting now, but eventually they will. Kennesaw, Georgia Southern, great programs that are either just beginning or been around for a while that are kind of reaping the second-tier player and allowing kids to play in-state here in Georgia. And I think it's an awesome experience to have more kids coming in and playing for local colleges. I think it's great.
Oh, absolutely. And as we were discussing earlier, how Georgia is really the number four biggest like talent pool in the U.S., and it's now creating so many more opportunities and stages for these kids that got passed over by the big colleges. They can still go and perform, and you can almost get, you know, kind of what Troy University in Alabama has done, where people like DeMarcus Ware were able to go there and create that platform so that they can transition straight in and be the superstars that they thought they were.
Yeah, I guess you could say you can be a big fish in a big pond, and some guys, that's Alabama, and that's Georgia, and that's probably a little bit of Tech, or some guys that may not be able to make it to that level. They're not recruiting. You know, Georgia can only recruit 24, 25 guys a year, and let's say you take 20 from the state. That still leaves about another 300 or 400 seniors that are probably good enough to play at the D1 level that are going to go to other schools. And so Troy and South Alabama, you can go up to Tennessee and even further up. I mean, there are people from all over that are plucking really good athletes and giving them a chance to play at a D1 school, at an FCS caliber university. Florida, Texas, California, and it used to be what I would call the Ohio Valley. You've got some Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan kids that were all really big linemen and their parents were coal miners and they're just tough kids. There aren't as many right now, and there's more down here, and I think it's great, again, that the locals here in Georgia are getting seen, they're getting a chance to play, and they're playing well when they're put into a ball game, and that, I think, is allowing the footsteps for other coaches to go, hey, you got a bunch of kids from Georgia, maybe we should start recruiting there as well.
Yeah, absolutely, Coach, I believe you had a question for Harper?
I do have a question for you, Harper. My question for you is, now that the team has been basically fielding their home games in the Dome, how has that played a role in the recruiting, and what does that do with it as they move into the new facility? What does Georgia State do with that situation moving forward?
Well, the great thing for me, if I'm a recruit from Georgia State, is to look where we play. We play where the Atlanta Falcons do, and there's only a couple of other schools, Pittsburgh being one of them, that has the same ability to say that we house an NFL team. Now, the problem with that is that, as anyone who's been to a game or seen one, the Georgia Dome looks empty. Even if the lower bowl is full, it still looks empty, and so that's a hard thing. I think the facility is too big for the program at the moment. But overall, I think, again, starting with a program that didn't even exist in 2009, anything is an improvement. Anything is, as far as academics and the school itself, their desire to become a first-rate program and to do it with a first-class facility like the Georgia Dome, I think it's a blessing to be able to have that and be able to borrow it on Saturdays. How they do with the new stadium, that's a few years away. There's a $300 million question that we'll all be looking to answer. But, they're shuffling balls in the air right now trying to juggle this financially. But if they are able to pull it off, it will be. I think it'll be a much better fit for what the university is trying to accomplish.
Well, I do thank you for answering that question for me.
You bet. And, look forward. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I was done.
Oh. You are quite the busy person, especially I guess you might be busier now that you're out of the game than when you actually laced them up. But you also do a lot of work on Friday nights. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, a few years ago, I was interested in the lovely realm of radio. There was no streaming back in those days. I don't get to live large like you guys do, and I'm kind of teasing there. But I figured I would try broadcasting and up in the Gainesville area. They've got a radio station that did Friday night games, and I thought, as big as it is out here, I'd love to be a part of that, and interviewed and talked to a few folks, and my name isn't exactly the same as Jamal Anderson or Bob Whitfield, but I guess I can articulate a little bit, and was able to start doing games on Friday night. It keeps me young. I love doing it. I get to see some kids that really have a tremendous heart and a desire. They're not as talented yet, but you can see different pieces of the puzzle kind of forming in the way that they figure things out as sophomores and juniors. And I just love it. Friday night high school football is the core of American football in and of itself. There's more people that go to high school games collectively than college on Saturdays and then obviously the pros. Now, more people watch the pro game on television, but that's, you know, a different story. It's a great event. People love it, and I do too. So getting to be a part of that was just really a blessing for me, and I really appreciate it. And I've got to see some really good players watch Deshaun Watson for all 4 years. He's going to go to Clemson. I'm sure you guys will be talking about him in 4 years, see if the Falcons want to draft him. But a lot of other talent that, these are just you watch these kids get bigger and stronger and faster, and you hope. You wish for them, you pray for them to be able to go and do it in college and get an education. And if they get a scholarship to boot, that would be, you know, icing on the cake. That's just a part of me and my love of the game that I love to see passed down from one generation to the next.
Yeah,
hey,
absolutely.
Hey, Mr. LaBelle, I've got one question for you. As I'm looking at the faces of about five kids here who are all at the middle school level, and they're just enamored with the fact that, you know, that we're actually talking with an NFL, former NFL player, and someone as involved in youth sports as you are as well in the collegiate level, what advice could you give them that are aspiring to maybe go to the next level, whether it be collegiate or high school or what have you, as how to improve their games and handle themselves as professionals?
Boy, that's a great question. I appreciate you asking. There's nothing easy about hard work. Or otherwise it would be called something else. So there's a lot of things that I would recommend in terms of how you conduct yourself in practices and how hard it is for you to work through things. But the ones that can push themselves through that, they're the ones that end up playing. They're the ones that end up getting on TV on Sundays. I was very fortunate in that I had a skill, long snapping, that not many people had. Not many people work on, and it isn't all that important until fourth down. But going through the other motions that you have to, working out, lifting weights, being in shape, and the biggest piece of that, I know that there are countless other players that are bigger than me, stronger than me, faster than me, smarter than me, but in one way, shape, or form, they may have been distracted. So the biggest key that I would say is whatever talent you have, don't be distracted from maximizing that to becoming the best possible player that you can be. For your coach in high school, if you are fortunate enough to get into college, love the game, but push yourself through it in ways that other people don't by not giving in to some of the distractions that would keep you from getting where you want to go. I'm sure you have, Coach, a lot of other points of emphasis on top of that, but that to me would be the easiest and simplest answer.
Great, great answer. And I had a follow-up from a 10-year-old here that has some questions in regards of he's getting more conscious about the types of things that he eats and his nutrition. So that's what his question hinges around. What are the types of things, if anything, that you would recommend that he start to do as far as his nutrition is concerned that can help him build himself into the player he wants to become?
Well, I tell you what, as a 10-year-old, did you and I ever think about that? I mean, I was eating Cap'n Crunch cereal and hot dogs and stuff today. It's just, you look at what's in it, you go, why? What are we thinking? How could we do that?
Absolutely.
But, the consciousness of that and staying away from chips and sodas and stuff that is not conducive to where you want to go, that won't fuel your body in the right way. For a 10-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 16-year-old to be able to discipline themselves, to be able to say, you know what, I'm just not going to have that candy bar, or I'm going to turn down that extra bowl of ice cream. There are certain things you need from a caloric standpoint to get you to be able to perform. You know, a defensive back doesn't eat the same food all the time as what a lineman would, but still, nonetheless, how you fuel your body is so critical. And taking the right vitamins and supplementing yourself if you need to, and eating the right stuff. Boy, a 10-year-old that is even conscious of that right now is so far ahead of the game from where I was. I think it's awesome. So, yes, study. Learn about foods. What are complex carbohydrates? Why is brown rice better for me than white rice? Or why is wild rice better than a potato or French fries? Being able to build off of some of the simple foods maximizing that and putting the right ones in your body, it's critical.
Absolutely. And I think, again, it was validation from an old guy telling him. So he had to hear it from an NFLer. So I appreciate that.
I'm grateful that I'm echoing what you're already teaching him, right? We're all on the same page. But there's so many 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, 18-year-olds that can do stuff, that can run and lift and do stuff most 10-year-olds couldn't do back in the 60s or 70s when I was growing up. I just think it's amazing how we've evolved. Quick story. You guys may remember the name Ron Mix. Ron was an offensive tackle with the San Diego Chargers, and he's in the Hall of Fame. He was great. He was one of the few guys in the early 1970s that could bench press 400 pounds. Nowadays, there's probably only two guys that can't bench 400 pounds, so we have gotten bigger and stronger, and like it or not, the collisions are faster because guys are moving. E equals MC squared. It's just simple as that. But, you know, taking care of your body and all that, the key, and I'm glad that I was able to echo something that you're already teaching.
Also, Mr. LaBelle, I'd like to add to that from a coach's perspective. I've had the privilege of standing on an NFL sideline, and as you speak of the speed of the game, I don't think you can appreciate how good athletes are in the NFL until you feel that breeze come past you on a kickoff. I think a lot of it has to do with what you're speaking of, how well you take care of your body, because at that level you have to take care of your body. And I mentioned on the end zone that you're never really out of season. So all of these things that you're speaking of is something that has to start really early in life to get it embedded so that it can be a continuum as they move through high school, transition into college, and then hopefully play as professional athletes.
Yeah, a coach when I was in high school who I admire most for just his compassion with me, a pat on the back, a word of encouragement, I asked him once, his name was Paul Napier, and I said, "Hey, Coach Napes, why are you doing this? Why are you coaching?" He goes, "Harps, let me tell you, there is nothing to me, nothing quite like being on the sideline during an opening kickoff." And I think I don't need to say anything more. It just speaks volumes about there's something special about it. And part of the reason is because it's not easy. It's difficult. Part of the reason is because it's so short, that time span, 3 or 4 years in high school. If you're fortunate to get into college and not redshirt, 3 or 4 years where you get to actually play and you're in front of the stands. And with one-day career or 12 or 14, 17 years, it flies by like that. So it's very unique. And it's amazing. And then those that take advantage of it, rather than being taken advantage of, that's another one of the keys. I think it's awesome, and I'm glad you, all of you, appreciate the game as much as you do.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I mean, we say every week on these shows, and we hear all the other guys on the other networks, and everybody say about how the game has changed, and at least from your perspective back when you played to where the game is now, what do you think the major changes are?
Well, one of the more obvious is the population of the United States is bigger. So there's more kids that are doing things that I was doing 20 years ago, or a guy like Steve Barkowski or Tommy Nobis when he was the first player, you know, Mr. Falcon back in the 60s. So the speed and the size, the amount of collisions, the pace of the game is different. You remember Barkowski in 1980 and 81 and 82 threw for about 3,500 yards, and he led the league in passing. Now he'd barely be able to stay on a roster if he threw for 3,500 yards because everyone's throwing for 4,000 and 5,000. So it's interesting how the throwing game and being able to pass has kind of eclipsed. I think the direction we're going is we're probably not going to run as much because you don't need to. If I can get 8 yards with a pass, and then you extend the game, if you think about it, because it doesn't take as long, we're getting more plays in. Look what Oregon is doing. They're running 80, 90, 100 plays per ball game. I don't think that's going away. I don't think the spread offense is going away from the NFL. You're seeing more people that can run it now, and it will start to incorporate into the pro game. So those are some things I would immediately say that are transitions that we need to be prepared for, because that's what the players at high school and college are starting to do. So it's going to be obvious that it'll trickle into the pro game as well.
And on end zone, we've talked about some other things I was going to bring up. One being the new quarterback trend is to kind of redshirt some of these rookie quarterbacks like coming out of the gate, and not just with quarterbacks, but do you think it should be something more, you know, more popular among the teams to start kind of, you know, as you draft these important young prospects, should you kind of give them a year to season, or should you just kind of throw them out there and let them learn to swim quickly?
I think that the last guy that I think of immediately is Carson Palmer. When he was drafted by the Bengals, they sat him and told him, we're going to sit you for a year. Sam Bradford and Matthew Stafford and just about everybody else has been put right into the kitchen and told, let's go, turn up the heat. We're going to play with you regardless. You're making too much money, and that part of the reason is why. I don't think your second, third rounders, your fourth rounders certainly are probably not going to replace the starter. It's just my opinion of the way it's going. If you're going to make big money, they're going to put you on the field right away. I think Johnny Manziel is destined to start from day one unless he's hurt or unless he just steps all over his feet and can't do it because of the money he's going to be making. So it's not quite what you earn in terms of your practice time and what you can do in a ball game. It's what the salary cap and what you make that's going to have a lot to do with how much playing time you're going to be given initially. You'll earn it and keep it if you play well.
And the other big highly debated topic that we've had from callers and other fans of the show and just between us before the show start is does the league need a feeder league, so to say, or like a kind of like a D league like you get in the NBA, so that you can draft more players and you have so many talented people, instead of putting them on a practice squad, have like a league where they can develop like NFL Europe used to be?
Well, if I can go back in history briefly, the 1987 strike was the reason that the NFL Europe organization went into effect. The league was caught with their shorts down when the players said, we're going to strike, we want better working conditions. So to keep that from being an issue where you couldn't have football on Sundays during the season, they developed other players. They put them in a place where they could play overseas. They didn't have great attendance, but it wasn't too bad. But you're introducing in Amsterdam and Barcelona and London, they had teams so that you could field enough guys to put a league together if there was another strike. Now, we haven't had any of that, so I'm not sure how it's going to work. I don't know if it would functionally work in Portland or Salt Lake City or Birmingham. And when would you play? You certainly aren't going to compete in those cities for Saturday games, and you don't want to compete and have people not go to your NFL game to go visit the D-League game. So I don't know. It's a great thought. They do need other players to fill in at times. But I'm not sure exactly how you would do that without growing and expanding the league in general.
Makes sense. Hey, Coach LaBelle, Mr. LaBelle, I got one more question that I wanted to kind of pick brain. I know Coach Hill and I, as we're wrapping up the show, Coach Hill and I have had a couple of conversations about this in the past. One of the things, and my primary trade is in technology, but one of the things that I'm very passionate about, especially since I have younger kids in my area that play football at the Pop Warner level, that I am very concerned about is this trend of concussions and injuries or head injuries specifically as it relates to these players. So I wanted to be able to pick your brain, even if not now, but even later, about what your thoughts would be as far as how we could maybe utilize technology or do some things to try to curtail some of those injuries.
That's a great question, Reggie. And I think the league, I think all of football from the Pop Warner all the way up to the very emphasis of Roger Goodell's ear in the NFL, that is a key portion of the way that the business of football has got to change. We've got to find a way to allow the game to stay aggressive and tough and physical, but yet where it's not as harmful, especially in the long term. It's got to be fun in some respects, but it isn't. There's a lot of hard work, and we mentioned that. But how do we keep our kids safe? And I guess the first thing that I would think of away from technology, and I'm not disagreeing with you, I think it's critical that we take advantage of whatever technology we have and put it in and involve it in the game, but I think the basics come down to blocking and tackling, and we're going to have to start teaching, and some of your Pop Warner dads don't know any better. I use the expression, you can't teach what you don't know, and some of them are going to have to start learning different ways to tackle and to protect the players and maybe with their shoulder more than their head and try new different ways of still playing the game, but doing it in a way where it's safer, especially for the younger bodies, and keep them from having any type of injury. When you get older, especially in college and in the pros, you can be covered for some of that medically. You have highly paid trainers, but in the younger levels, it may not be the same. So I would, Reggie, want to encourage the basics of the game, the fundamentals, to start looking at different ways that might be better to develop the game and teach the younger kids a way to do it that is still physical but not as harmful.
Absolutely. Makes sense. Thank you so much.
What I'd like to also add to that, Mr. LaBelle, is that I do agree that the teaching process has to be put back in place. What I notice with a lot of college athletes is that you don't see a lot of good fundamentals. And once you place fundamentals back into it, I think that's where you're going to be able to incorporate with the rules of the NFL, the safety factor. It's just proper technique.
Yeah, and we are winding down real quick here, and as we have the last few seconds, I do want to thank former Atlanta Falcon tight end, at least the one I remember the most besides that Gonzalez guy, Harper LaBelle, for calling in. We appreciate you calling in.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on, Jeremy, anytime, and I know you guys need to wrap up. So have a great evening, and again, thank you for the invitation. I look forward to it again.
It is no problem. We look forward to having you on again. But for Reggie Walker and Coach Haywood Hill, I am Jeremy York. This has been Falcon Zone featuring Harper LaBelle. We'll see you guys next week.